Hello, good evening, and welcome to Cobden Centre Radio with me, your host, Andy Duncan. Tonight, I'm joined by best-selling author Richard Blake, creator of the Aelric franchise series. This includes Conspiracies of Rome, The Terror of Constantinople, The Blood of Alexandria, and his latest published work, The Sword of Damascus. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Andy, and many thanks for having me on the programme.
My pleasure. The Aelric series weaves between the fallen Latin Roman Empire in the west and the surviving Byzantine Roman Empire in the east, all set around the beginning of the Dark Ages. When the Western Roman Empire fell in circa 476 AD, the whole crumbling mass was mired in bureaucracy, corruption, serfdom, stagnation, taxation, and crippling inflation, a situation entirely similar to our own position today within the EU. The EU itself may be an all too conscious recreation of the old Western Roman Empire, formed as it was by the 1957 Treaty of Rome, which was ratified on the very site of the old Temple of Jupiter Maximus on the Capitoline Hill of Rome. The Eastern Roman Empire, however, survived until as late as 1453 AD, a very late time, and this may have been due to its hard policy of hard money, especially the purity of its gold bezant, also known as the solidus, which eventually became the gold dinar of the Ottoman Empire. As an expert in Roman history, I thought Mr. Richard Blake could shed some light for us upon our own more enlightened experiments in government-managed debasement of currency. Okay, Richard, what do you think of my summation so far?
It's well said, I think, Andy. Let's look at the classical period of the Roman inflation, the 3rd century. Now, there are many parallels with today's situation, but let me begin by giving you the background. And there are not many parallels between the Roman situation and our own in the ultimate background. The first thing to remember about the Roman Empire, as indeed about all pre-modern societies, is that it was desperately poor. Oh, you've seen the ruins in Rome, you've seen the films, you've seen the pictures by Alma Tadema, and you think of the Roman Empire as a place of fabulous luxury. And so it was for about 1%, but for the other 99%, it was a place of desperate poverty. So far as we can tell, life expectancy in the empire in the 3rd century was rather like life expectancy in India 100 years ago. That means that most people died in their late 20s, early 30s. Now, given this situation of crushing, almost universal poverty, it can be extremely difficult, maybe impossible, to increase the amount of money that you can collect from the people in tax. And the central fact of Roman politics from the middle of the 2nd century onwards is that a relatively easy period on all the frontiers came to a simultaneous end. You have the replacement of the Parthian Empire, a rather ramshackle organization, by an extremely aggressive and efficient Persian Empire in the east. In the north, you have various chaotic bands of Germans replaced by entire kingdoms, the Goths, for example, pushing south, pushing very hard south, meaning that you have to fortify the Rhine and the Danube rivers all the time. Then you have the problems with the North African provinces, with the British provinces. You have simultaneous pressures on every frontier that the Roman Empire has. It means that you need more soldiers, you need to pay the soldiers more, your military budget explodes, and you need to get the money from somewhere. And if you cannot squeeze more money very easily out of the people, something has to give somewhere. Another point about the Roman tax system is that, well, there wasn't one by modern standards. There was no central budget. There was no way of matching taxes to expenditure. There was no way of increasing taxes. For example, in modern Britain, you need to get more money out of the people. You shove up income tax. You shove up VAT. You put these taxes up. There's some evasion. There's some slippage. But the money does roll in eventually. In the Roman Empire, most taxes were set at the municipal level. And they were based mostly on very old agreements, stipulations, treaties, assessments. So in order to increase the amount of tax you took, you had to go around almost every single municipality in the empire reassessing tax rates. It was much easier just to call in 100 silver coins, mix them in with a certain amount of copper, and reissue 120 supposedly silver coins. The fraud is obvious, but the first people to spend the money do manage to get something like 20% extra things. But by minting more coins, you don't increase the number of things that are literally bought with the coins, but what you do is you give the government's purchasing power a considerable boost.
That will bring us on later to something I wanted to ask you about in the 7th century with the Byzantine Empire, but I just wanted to give everyone listening to this an idea of the debasement. Augustus inherited a Republican silver denarius, which was 95% precious metal, and then by Trajan and his column and his invasion of Dacia, this was down to 85%. Marcus Aurelius, which most people know, played by Sir Alec Guinness or Richard Harris, depending on which film they prefer, debased this down to 75%, and then we get down to, in the 3rd century, Caracalla, of his famous baths, who made Nero look like a kind of Boy Scout. He took it all the way down to 50% silver. This decline around the edges of the empire, around Parthia and Germany and so on, do you think that this was instigated by this debasement, or did it cause the debasement, or were the two related in some particular way?
Cause and effect are very difficult things to work out in historical terms. Indeed, George Orwell once made the point that a man may start drinking heavily because he thinks he's a failure, and then he will become even more of a failure because of his heavy drinking. But I think the beginning of the Roman problem was the increased pressure on the frontiers. Until the middle of the 2nd century, the Roman Empire had it easy, but by the middle of the 2nd century, it was like finding yourself in a nutcracker. The hand holding a nutcracker was flexing more and more, so they needed the money. Now, of course, once you start debasing the coinage, a number of things happen. In the first place, because, as I said, the tax system was extremely rigid. Let's suppose that the assessment for a particular district in Syria was 100 denarii, 100 silver coins. You debase the coinage, and that Syrian assessment is still 100 coins. And so you're getting less on your assessed tax, and so you need to debase the coinage more, because you have to pay the soldiers, which, of course, reduces the amount of actual tax that you're receiving. And it continues. And so once you start this process of currency debasement, you really have no choice but to carry on, or to bring about a fundamental reform to the whole financial and general administration of the empire. Now, of course, once the empire was in the grip of this inflation or this currency debasement, any number of other pressures emerge. And this may have had something to do with the chronic political instability of the empire in the central years of the 3rd century. But to come back to the question you asked, what caused the problem? I think the problem is the external increase in pressure on the empire. But for that, the currency debasement would probably not have begun, or wouldn't have proceeded as dramatically as it did.
This downward spiral, it sort of began in 217 AD, when they're about 50% silver. Then they followed the Barak's emperors, and by 268 AD, about 50 years later, they were down to a silver denarius, which was one half of 1% of precious metal. So your downward spiral had really taken hold. But the Western Roman Empire survived until 476, almost 200 years later. How did they manage to keep it going that long?
Something which is rather hard for us to realise is that pre-modern societies were not that heavily exposed to a monetary economy. Until about 300, maybe 400 years ago, even in Western Europe, most people were not that heavily exposed to a monetary economy. In the Roman Empire, most of the productive classes, which is the people who worked the land, would simply not have used money for their everyday needs. It would have been in-house production, or it would have been a barter exchange. And so, although if you look at the silver ratio in the coinage, it does look like something like a Weimar-style inflation. I don't think it's something that affected most ordinary people. It is something that affected the state and those people who did business for the state, but it didn't really touch the productive classes.
Did the Roman Empire start taking in taxes in produce, in goods and grain and so on?
Yes, it did. Once the coinage had effectively died, the empire began making direct requisitions of materials, and this did continue for quite a while. Of course, it is far less efficient, or far less convenient, let's say, for the authorities to collect food and leather goods and other things in Syria, and then transport them to the Rhine and the Danube frontiers, that then to collect taxes in gold or silver, and then buy things near to the area of military operation. But once the coinage had become a joke, that was one means of weathering the crisis. And it worked. There is no doubt that by the 270s, the empire, which had looked very much on the edge of collapse for much of the century, was restabilizing itself. The pressure on the frontiers was being met by an equal outward pressure. And in some cases, the empire was going on the attack. So yes, the empire survived this period of inflation and political instability.
One half of the empire, of course, the Byzantine Empire, survived until 1453. And one of the major reformers who helped that was the Emperor Constantine. When he reformed the money supply, £1 of gold equaled 20 million denarii. How did the Byzantines survive until 1453? And how did they keep a good, honest money supply for a very long period of time when the empire split in two?
We have no statistics, by the way. We don't even know what the population of the city of Rome was in about the year 300. We don't know what the population of the empire as a whole was. We don't know what the budget of the empire was. We really are flying blind. If you're talking about the budgetary problems faced by the French monarchy in the 1780s, we have all the information we could ever need. In fact, we know far more about it than the French at the time did. But once you start talking about budgetary pressures and other difficulties faced by the Roman Empire, we really don't have that much direct primary evidence. We don't know that much about it. We know about the gold and silver content of the coinage. We know about areas of territory that were lost or gained. We have literary histories, but we just don't know what was going on in the financial councils of the empire. So far as we can tell, given that very big reservation, the eastern part of the empire, the Greek-speaking half, was always more populous and more wealthy than the western part. It also had a much shorter critical frontier. The western part had to deal with the Rhine and much of the Danube frontier, a very, very long frontier, sparsely populated but very heavily infiltrated, whereas the Eastern Empire had to deal with the eastern part of the Danube frontier and the Euphrates frontier. The Euphrates was potentially more dangerous because that was the border between the Roman and the Persian empires. On the other hand, unlike with most of the shifting bands of barbarians to the north, you could do deals with the Persians. You could sign a treaty for 20 years up front, and the Persians would by and large stick to it. You knew roughly where you were with the Persians. Sometimes there was an all-out war, and then that would bring on a general crisis of the Eastern Empire. But for the most part, the Roman and Persian empires were at peace. As for the part of the Danube frontier that the East defended, well, ultimately, the Balkans were expendable. You could allow the Danube frontier to collapse, and if bands of Slavs and Avars and other barbarians began pouring down, you just withdrew. You kept cities like Thessalonica and Adrianople. You kept Corinth. You kept the main points. But you didn't worry too much about it. The heart of the Eastern Empire was what is now Turkey and Syria and Egypt. And those relatively easy to defend for the most part. And so the Eastern half did have a big advantage of the West. It was richer. It was more populous, it was more compact, it was easier to defend. It survived.
In the 7th century AD, the Eastern Roman Empire faced the same sort of situation as the Western Roman Empire in the 3rd century. You have the Persians from the east coming in, and the Arabs from the south, and the Slavs from the north, and the Byzantine Empire got down almost to a sort of city-state of Constantinople. But at no point did they debase the money. They kept the solidus as an honest money. How did they manage to retain an honest money, even under all that kind of pressure?
The easiest way to answer your question is to say, I don't know. How is it that the Roman Empire as a whole faced a great problem in the 3rd century and dealt with that problem by hyperinflation? And yet the eastern part of the empire was nearly destroyed, nearly wiped away twice in the 7th century and didn't inflate. How is it that the Roman government in the later period resisted the most obvious temptation of any government that's strapped for cash and in trouble, which is to debase the coinage or to inflate the money supply? One possible answer is that the Byzantine state did have something like a state budget. It had a reasonably flexible tax system, so it was able to match income to expenditure, not as efficiently as a modern state can, but much more efficiently than the Roman state ever could. Another possible reason, and we really don't know anything about this because all of the policy documents that might have been around at the time have since perished, but it may have been that there was a great deal of institutional experience in the Byzantine financial ministries. The emperor and his counselors may have said, let's just debase the coinage, that will get us out of this problem. And various elderly eunuchs came forward and said, oh, but your majesty, this was tried in the bad old days 400 years ago, and look what resulted. I really do strongly recommend against any debasement of the currency. We will find some other way to get through this crisis. Now, that would be an interesting possibility, wouldn't it? But we have no evidence for it because all of the relevant documents have perished. But I do suspect, the more I think about it, that's what happened.
Do you think this is similar to the German central bank in the 1950s and 60s with the strong Deutschmark policy, looking back at the Weimar Germany and the problems that caused?
Yes, because unless you have faced a serious inflation, it's very hard to see what the problem is. I do remember people in the early 1990s, and Britain, let's face it, Britain has faced a creeping inflation since 1914. We've never had anything approaching hyperinflation. I remember people telling me in the early 90s that, we have a choice between unemployment and inflation. So let's inflate it, dear. A bit of inflation doesn't matter. We live in a country which has not really suffered a serious inflation. It's only when you do know about countries like Germany or Hungary, or perhaps the Roman Empire of the 3rd century, which have faced these problems, and you've seen the random redistributions of wealth, you have seen the wholesale fraud on the poorer classes, the systematic fraud and injustice that inflation represents. Only when you've seen that and have some historical understanding of it is there any resistance to renewed inflation.
Moving into the future, we have our own glorious thousand-year EU, which is a stepping stone on the road to world government. Do you think it's more like the Eastern Roman Empire, which has learned some lessons from the past, or do you think it's more like the Western Roman Empire, which is just grabbing at straws to solve every situation?
I wouldn't compare the European Union with either halves of the Roman Empire. Let's not be sentimental about the Roman Empire. It was not some voluntary commonwealth of peoples. It was brought together by brute armed force, and it was held together by brute armed force. In ways that the European Union has not been, at the same time, however, there was a conception of the public good in the Roman Empire which does not and cannot exist in the European Union. There was a shared loyalty to the emperor in the earlier periods. In the later periods, there was a shared loyalty to the emperor and a shared and a common adherence to the Orthodox Christian faith. In all periods, there was a general adherence to a certain standard of classical civilization. That there was much that bound the Roman Empire together apart from brute military force. There is nothing holding the European Union together, not even brute military force. It has no staying power. I am surprised that the European Union has lasted as long as it has and as well as it has. It is now just over 50 years old. I really have trouble believing that it will survive another 50 years, whereas the Roman state lasted from 753 BC to about 476 AD. You're looking at 1,200 years. Then another 1,000 years on top of that for the Byzantine state. Well, I find it difficult to believe that any Brussels-based institution will last even a tenth of that length of time.
I think it was Mark Twain who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Using your wide historical knowledge, can you give us a general overview as to how you feel the EU is going to end?
I would like the European Union to end with a unilateral British withdrawal, followed by a financial and political crisis, which will break the whole thing up. However, the British political class is so corrupt, so wedded to the European dream. But I find it impossible to believe that there will be a unilateral British withdrawal. I think what is most likely is that some of the less likely, some of the more apparently Europhile member states will just get sick of it. It is possible, for example, that the Germans will dump the euro. It looks as if the only way to get the Greeks, the Italians, the Spanish, and the Portuguese out of catastrophic trouble is by inflating the euro. That is the only way these countries can stay in the euro and that the European Union can remain formally in its present shape. But if that happens, or if it seems to be happening, I rather suspect that the German political class will just lose faith in the project and will relaunch the Deutschmark. If that happens, that's the end of the European Union. Otherwise, you can imagine any number of other scenarios. I was recently in the Slovak Republic, and everyone regarded this, once it joined back in 24, everyone regarded the Slovak Republic as an obvious satrapy of the European Union. These people would go along with everything that was put in front of them to sign. And yet, the Slovaks held up the Greek bailout. And the Slovaks had good reason for doing that. In Slovakia, you carry on working until you're 60, and there's talk of raising that to 65, and the old age pension is a couple of hundred euros a month. And so the entire Slovak political class and the media and many ordinary people began asking, why on earth should we start putting money in to bail out the Greeks when they have it so much better than we have? Why on earth should Slovak pensioners suffer so that Greek pensioners can collect their inflated and unearned pensions? Ultimately, the Slovaks were whipped into line and they signed on the dotted line and the Greeks got their bailout cash. But even the most apparently Europhile states may not be as solidly in favour of everything that is needed to keep the European project going as may have been supposed.
Speaking of Slovakia, I understand you've been promoting some Slovakian translations of your work, and I was just wondering how The Sword of Damascus is doing.
Well, The Sword of Damascus hasn't yet been translated into Slovak. I was in Slovakia at the beginning of July, and Terror of Constantinople was launched on, I think, the 1st of July, and that went extremely well. We did the launch at the Pantarei bookshop in central Bratislava. There were Slovak media people in attendance, quite a large group of ordinary book-buying people, and there was a two-hour launch with drinks and canapes and speeches and questions. The whole thing videoed. There were then interviews on Slovak television. The Slovak publishing company will launch Blood of Alexandria in November when I should be back out here. The Slovak publishers are very enthusiastic about the entire series, as indeed are the Spanish, the Italians, the Greeks, the Hungarians, and the Chinese. They are doing very well. Sword of Damascus has only just been released in the UK, and that is as a hardback. There's only a limited print run of hardback novels because they're intended for libraries and collectors. And unfortunately, virtually the entire print run has disappeared from the market. And so people who make orders at the moment on Amazon, they will get the export paperback. I think the hardbacks have gone for the moment. If there is an overwhelming demand, Horror and Stout will print more hardbacks. It's just that it seems to be that for Horror and Stoughton to print more hardbacks of anything is almost as difficult as for the Roman Empire to... It just can't be done very easily.
I, as you know, have a personally signed copy of the first edition of your work, and we've been having Harry Potter fever here in the UK in the last couple of weeks, and I want to see some Aelric movies. What do you think the chances are of me seeing an Aelric movie and going to a Leicester Square premiere, or even a Trafalgar Square premiere?
Obviously, if that happens, I'll give you a ticket, and you'll be more than welcome. But what I've discovered with literary success is that it helps if you are a decent writer. It helps if you have a decent publisher. It helps if your publisher is doing the job properly. But really and truly, success, for the most part, at least 75, maybe 90%, comes down to luck.
We're on the fourth novel now. We're on Sword of Damascus. Can the Aelric fans look forward to a fifth novel?
They can indeed. I finished Ghosts of Athens just at the end of June, and I heard my publisher has now accepted the first draft of the manuscript, which means I don't need to rewrite any of it. I need to help sort out the several hundred rather gross typos in the manuscript, but I don't need to do any rewriting. And so Ghosts of Athens is now on the conveyor belt and will be published sometime around the 9th of June 2012.
So I'd like to thank you for your time tonight, Richard, for helping us illuminate ourselves about the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Empire and their inflations. Thank you and good night.
Thank you.